brothers and sisters. Welcome to episode 6 of Racks, Fur, and Feathers. Today we sat down with one of the most knowledgeable people I've ever had the privilege of talking to when it comes to the outdoors, Chuck Powell. We talked trapping today, coyotes specifically. We kept it real basic. There was a lot we wanted to get to. We just didn't have the time, unfortunately, so we're definitely going to have him back. We had an awesome time recording this. It's probably my favorite podcast to date, so I think you guys are going to love it. So, without further ado, the man, the legend, Chuck Powell. All right, we are live. I am sitting here today with Adam Peterson, as usual.
Hello.
Mr. Mustachio.
Thank you.
Ray Cole, who's over there in the corner with no microphone. And Chuck Powell, our local legend trapper. How you doing, Chuck?
Good, good.
How long have you been doing this?
Since, I would say 25 plus years, since I was 12. So I'm almost 50 now, so it's been a while.
Wow. Wow, that is a long time. So yeah. Who got you into it?
You know, I recall one time running a snare line with my father when I was very, very young. And then I happened to see some traps in the garage. So I asked my dad, hey, can I set some? I asked one of the neighbors if I could set the garden. And it just all went from there.
Awesome.
Went from there. So I had some mentors, actually in your area right here, John Crump and an older trapper, I can't recall his name right now, who's now passed, Burl High, actually what his name was, lived on the Dowagiac Creek, showed me some ways, and I just took it from there.
Wow. And you were taking them to market when you were?
You know, I sold local back in them times. There was a lot of local buyers. Now there's none. But during that time, there was a couple guys around here that I sold local to.
Speaking of buyers, did you guys see that San Francisco just put a ban on furs?
Yeah, I've seen that.
No, I didn't hear.
I don't believe half of what I see, but
yeah.
I don't know how true it is. But I did see that.
Yeah,
like furs coming into the city, or
the sale of furs and leathers within the city of San Francisco.
Well,
can't do it no more.
San Francisco.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say.
That's what he got,
yep.
You know.
Yep. I'll leave it at that. So,
how'd your season go this year so far?
It was a very good season. I ended the season with 76 coyotes.
Oh, wow.
18 reds, 63 coon, 99 rats, and I'm, I guess, around maybe 12 to 15 minks somewhere in there. And then I had some seven or eight beaver.
That's awesome.
Also, yeah.
Nice.
That's really
good.
Awesome.
It was good.
And for you don't know, the reds are red fox and rats are muskrats.
Correct. Yep. Correct.
How'd you do at market this year
Yeah, I have not taken nothing sold, so I take my furs to a depot who then takes them to Canada who offers two or three sales a year in front of a bunch of various people from all over the world go to that to buy furriers and stuff. So that sale will be, I think, in May. So my fur's up there, which is being tagged and ready to go to Canada.
And then, so how often do the prices fluctuate on that?
It fluctuates quite often. This time of year, your local buyers will adjust their prices depending on some of the international auctions that are taking place right now. There's two or three various international auctions. So every time one goes on, I've noticed some of the local guys just adjust their price. And, you know, it depends on how strong the American dollar is, the price of oil. A lot of political BS unfortunately goes into the fur deal.
Right. Is there one pelt that's worth more than the others? Is there one that you try to target the most to get the most out of? Or?
I try to look at the outlook of what last year brought,
mm-hmm.
and try to target that species that at the end of the year was selling well.
Okay.
It just happens this year it was coyotes.
It does fluctuate
a lot on the animal.
Okay.
And if it changes mid-swing, I change mid-swing.
Make the adjustment to get what you need to get in order to maximize your profit
for
the time that you spend in the field.
Sure. I try to.
It's a long process, right?
It is. I mean, a typical day is go to work. I work third shift, get off work, run kids to school, run traps, go home, catch an hour of sleep or so,
right,
go pick up kids from school, and do a pretty much of a repeat.
Wow.
So
that's, you gotta love it.
Yeah,
gotta love
yeah,
it.
It's awesome.
Absolutely a labor of love, because do you make a lot of money doing it? I mean,
honestly, no. The price of gas kills you.
Right.
It's more so, I do it more so as a passion or obsession or, you know, just chump change. It really is just chump change.
Right.
It's something... If I had to look at really what I made, I probably wouldn't want to look.
Yeah, yeah.
So how many pelts do you have to throw out usually?
It depends. I'll toss them because of mange or bad rubs. It just depends on the animal. The most I do throw out is always from a coyote because they're rubbed. Mm-hmm. And the pelt has no value then.
Now,
this past year, I threw out, I think, 28 that were no good. Yeah. Oh,
wow.
No good.
So wow. The ones that you mentioned at the beginning here are
that,
those...
Now, that 76 tally goes in straight into including those 28.
Okay.
That's what I harvested.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, like we covered this a little bit in episode 4 about when they go into prime and what that is. Could you maybe explain that? You can probably do it a lot better than I
Yeah,
can.
I could try. Prime is when the animal's leather on the inside and its fur is at its most prime condition as far as condition as, I guess, most luxurious condition.
Like thick and full?
Thick. The like it'll have a dense under fur
mm-hmm.
and long guard hair to keep right. them warm in the winter. And then the leather itself, the underneath, you know, that the hair grows out of, is thicker and more dense too.
Okay.
And it turns from fall to winter, it turns from blue to white.
Okay, that's what you had mentioned before
right.
about being in the blue.
Yeah, blue right. is early, what we call early.
Okay.
And buyers can pick that out right now, you know what I mean? And they'll downgrade you for that early
so
fur.
It's better to have an animal that's just outside of the blue that still has that luxurious coat.
You want white leather and as thick a fur as you can get.
Okay.
That's why animals in Alaska, Canada, Minnesota are better because they got longer seasons.
Right.
So it's fair to say when they go into the prime, so the earlier the better for coyote.
The market wants prime condition.
Yeah.
And coyotes in our area come into prime roughly around late November, early December.
And that's
and season opens in October.
Right.
For Indiana. I don't know what it does in Michigan.
Now, in Michigan, I think you could actually foothold all year long. I might be wrong on that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure myself. I know so very little about trapping that I can't even
so
guess.
Right. So in Michigan, I know you can't snare until January 1st.
Correct. And I think only January can you snare canines, red fox, gray fox, or coyotes in January.
Okay.
Okay.
And then there's stipulations on that, on your snare, what kind of snare, you know, and stuff like that.
I know, yeah. It's like each individual trap has its own set of regulations on it as far as safety devices it has to have so that, like in a snare, you don't get a deer.
They don't call them snares in Michigan. They're called cable restraints.
Okay.
Indiana, we can call them snares because we don't have a cable restraint
okay.
laws. Indiana's different.
Different verbiage but for yeah. the same tool. It's just...
Right.
The way
I call them snares because I used to call them snares.
Right.
And you know.
Well, we know what they are as snares. You know, you call it a cable restraint or whatever just to be in the books to be doing it the right way.
Right.
But we know what you're talking about.
Right.
So, yeah. So in Michigan then, so November, December, you can only use footholds. You want to go over what that is?
Well, foothold obviously is... they make various sizes of footholds. For coyotes, you should use probably anything between a 1.75 and a number 3.
What do those numbers mean?
That means jaw width dimension.
Gotcha.
So okay. a 1.75, I'm guessing, is around 5 1/4. A number 2 is 5 1/2. A number 3, maybe 5 3/4. And a number 4, a 6 inches.
Okay.
And depending on, I'm not sure about Michigan, I can run up to a number 4 in Indiana as long as it has offset jaws. In Michigan, I'm not really sure what you guys can run.
Okay.
As your maximum land trap without being covered underwater or stuff, you know, because of the you know, hunting dogs and stuff like that.
Right.
So, but yeah, and it's for those of you who don't know, it's a it's a
spring-loaded jawed trap.
It's like
with a pan in the center,
like what you see in the cartoons, right?
Yep.
Except
without the teeth,
without the jagged teeth on it.
There's not a state now within the U.S. that allows
the
teeth okay. tooth trap. Yep.
Okay, and they basically the point is to get them to step on that center pan, and the jaws clamp their feet, and it's they're not designed to hurt them.
No. Just it's a restraint device.
Right.
You know.
Just holds them long enough for, and when you're running a trap line, you try and check your traps every day.
That's the law, every 24 hours.
Right. And
both so, Indiana and Michigan.
Okay. So now if somebody was going to Real King or wherever, or going on Amazon to go buy some traps and get set up, what all would they need? They would need...
For land trapping coyotes, you would need, obviously, the... Whatever, regardless of what you're trapping, but for coyotes, I would recommend at least a 1.75. A good starter trap is a 1.75 or a number two size trap. You need a sifter for sifting the dirt, a trowel for digging, and some bait and lure, and obviously a pouch or a 5-gallon bucket to carry the stuff in. Also, staking, re-rod for staking your traps. Or they make disposable stakes that you can buy. I'm not sure if Rural King sells them or not, but there's disposable style stakes that are more lighter weight, and basically they're a cable on the end of a they're cable. There's a chunk of metal, and then it's cable, and that chunk of metal basically goes down into the ground. You drive it down into the ground with its driver, and when you pull it up, it goes from straight. Turning parallel with the ground so it doesn't come out.
So it locks in.
It's a lot lighter than re-rod.
Right.
A lot lighter than re-rod.
Which if you're using that, you use two pieces, right, and you crisscross?
You can. Depending on your soil conditions, clay ground, you wouldn't have to do that. But black soil, for sure.
If you're now, do you put it in like, if you're using one on clay ground, would you put it straight down or like at an angle?
One piece of re-rod?
Yeah.
You get straight down, be fine.
Yeah.
You know, but again, I mean, I use cable stakes, so it doesn't matter what ground I'm on. It works right for all of them.
And this, again, is what makes trapping such a tricky thing to do, is because there are certain variables that are involved: the size of your trap, the animal that you're after, the ground that you have to trap in, the land that you're trapping on.
Right.
There's so many different things that come into play
for
you to be an effective trapper.
Right.
You really have to... a lot of times be case specific when you set each individual trap,
because there's certain farms I have traps dedicated to that farm,
right?
You know what I mean? Or certain, like there's a river line I run, I have traps dedicated to that, what is best for that river and works well, and it lands no different.
And so a lot of people that would want to get into trapping, is there just a general setup that you would suggest? If you're starting, you don't know anything about trapping.
All right, the traps that come from the store, stock traps will get you by for the first year, but you want to try to learn it along the way,
right,
and read and research and stuff.
Right.
But
that's part of the sport, is you're constantly evolving to match the conditions that you have to exist in. You know, you want to be the most efficient trapper you can be, so you want to do the best job you can do, and that's learning from every trap set that you make. Even now, I would assume, I know for me, every time I walk in the woods to go hunting, I'm learning something new. Mm-hmm. You know, I always try to...
always looking, always trying to learn.
Absolutely. You know?
And traps have come a long ways now, too. So if you was to start out coyote trapping, I cannot think of any traps on the market now that isn't set up already for a good starter coyote trap.
Okay. Now, what about boiling them? Is that important?
You know, I do the boil, dye and wax. It's old school. It's the way I brought up. And, mm-hmm. and actually, it's a fun day just to do that. Take a day, you know, no different than going out to the range or going out shooting your bow or whatever. It's just a fun time for me because it brings back a lot of memories from the past of doing that. It's not necessary. But the least you should do is wax. When you get a trap from Rural King, first thing you should do is either throw it in the dishwasher or hand wash it with some detergent to get the oil off of it. Leave it outside, let it get a little bit of rust, and then wax that trap. The wax protects the trap, and it also lubricates the trap. Just makes it function a lot more better.
Okay.
And then as your seasons, as you, if you, next season, once that trap is like got a nice coat of rust or whatever,
right.
The dye, it take that dye's got, needs rust to adhere to. So
to penetrate into the metal and stick to it.
So when I get new traps, I just wash them clean to get all the oil off. I wax them that season, and then just keep running them season after season after season until I need to start adding dye.
So it's almost like, I guess, antiquing a little bit. You want that patina on the trap because the older trap will have that, for lack of a better word, experience where it's got the dye soaked in already and it's got the memory, you know, in the springs. You are used to working with it. Are different traps temperamental? Is it
as far as in what way?
Just like a foothold trap, are there any things that you have to do to be a little more safety conscious with it as opposed to like a conibear?
Well, obviously, or bigger traps you want to be more careful with.
Right.
But the only way you're going to learn that is get stung a few times.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I still do to this day, but it doesn't faze me anymore. A lot of guys, oh my God, you know?
Right.
But that's all part of the learning curve.
I know.
They look pretty violent when they go off.
Yeah.
They're quick.
It's not anywhere I'd want my hand to be. I saw a video of a kid online a couple weeks ago. He got his nose caught in one of the traps. It was a foothold trap. They had the teeth on it.
Yeah. And that's a trap. That actual trap, I seen that video.
Yeah.
Is an Australian rabbit trap of some sort. I think, and don't quote me on this, but I think in Australia, they may still be able to use those, you know?
Okay. Well, it looked painful. It looked like,
yeah, I wouldn't do it.
No, hell no.
Yeah. I don't know what he's proven, but he proved that he's dumb.
Yeah, you know? And then he got to put it online for everybody to see, so we all got to learn from his mistake.
Yeah.
So just...
And the dye, let me say, once your trap is rusted, it takes dye. That dye prevents rust.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you have to dye your traps? You're burying them in dirt. You're burying them under the ground. No, you don't have to. You don't have to. I see a lot of trappers just to do it, will paint them yellow or orange, or they're getting buried in dirt. The coyotes don't even see them.
Right.
You know, whatever it takes to protect that trap for longevity, you know. I mean, I've had traps that are 20, 30 years old.
Right.
You know, is the best you take care of your equipment, you're gonna get it out of there. You know.
I don't have any trapping experience myself, but I've helped my grandpa get his traps around, and he's more of an amateur trapper. He does it just to do it because he's retired and he just loves being outdoors. But he will boil his traps when he gets them just to kind of get that oxidation process started to let them come.
It removes the oils and stuff.
Right. It'll clean them up, and then it also will kind of help them rust a little bit faster.
Sure.
And
vinegar will do the same thing. You know, you cut vinegar 50-50 with water, spray that on your traps. That will help that come along.
Okay.
It's really not necessary, you know.
It's just if you want to do
If you want to do it, you want to go that route, you can.
Okay. And he dips his. I think he waxes them. He dyes them and waxes them, I think. But he always uses the same pair of gloves. Do you do the same thing? Is it?
No, jersey gloves,
right.
Cotton gloves.
Just so long
it's
as
not
a.
Got. It's. I know you'll read a lot or. The old style trapping, or the old trappers used to use rubber gloves and stuff. It's really not necessary, but some guys are just still stuck in that thing.
How big scent control was.
Yeah. I mean, I like to wear rubber boots for sure, even like deer hunting, because I've seen deer many times cross my path and know something's up.
Absolutely.
And the coyotes got just as good a nose, if not better.
Right.
So I do take those precautions.
Yeah, you're talking about a wild animal, something that lives day in and day out in the woods and relying on its sense of smell, its sense of sight, its sense of hearing.
Well, sure.
These things are keen as they can be in any animal that spends its life just living.
Any animal I've ever seen in the wild, they might question their ears, they might question their eyes, but they never question their nose.
Right. Absolutely.
All right, so now for the juice. All right, so a guy calls you, gives you permission for the farm. Do they give you do people hire you to come out and do this?
If they hire in Indiana, if they hire me for pay, I can't keep the animal.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you were telling me about that.
So,
yep.
Most of my landowners, it is all comes from word of mouth. You know, honestly, the better you are, the more, a lot of times, your name's going to be brought up first. I do control work for people, but it's typically in the off season. So, you know, or if I see a farm I'd like to have, I'll just go up just like old school and ask them, you
knock
know,
on
or
the
whatever.
Door and introduce yourself.
Yeah,
and
sure.
You say word of mouth.
Coyotes is a bad word around here. Yeah. It's actually kind of easy to get on good ground.
Before we get into the juice, what's your speech, man? Because there's a lot of people, I'm sure, that want to get in the trap.
I just
need a place to go. And
as far as
ask.
Asking the landowner, yeah. I mean, basically introduce myself.
Is there a certain time of day you go up to knock on the door?
Yeah, you know, you got to know the farmer's schedule, what time of year it is, and this and that. Typically, I'm re-upping my permission, even my old stuff, right now. Because nobody's in the fields, you know.
It's kind of the slow season for for being out.
Or I'll ask area farmers that I may have around that farm, you know, when's the farmer up there, what's the best time to get a hold of them, or they may know them and get a hold of them for me. And this, and it's just a lot of different ways, you know, or just go drive by the house and
you say
see
word,
a truck there.
Word
or leave
of
my
mouth
car.
Is the best advertisement, basically. Like, I've known who you are, not to sound weird, but like for the last couple of years.
Stalking me.
Well, no, I don't have a Facebook. I don't do any of that stuff. But I know the name Chuck Powell because everybody talks about what an amazing trapper you are.
Well,
but
sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes it's a bad thing. Depends on what side of your life I am on.
Absolutely.
Or,
when
you
introduce
I mean?
Yourself to people, it's like, hi, I'm Chuck Powell. I'd like to, you know, help you with your coyote problem. Like you said, coyote is a dirty word.
Sure.
Is there an easy way, like, if you know that they have a nuisance problem and you walk up and introduce yourself, do you just throw out the word coyote and, you know, let me help you with that? Or is there...
Typically, I'll tell them I'm trapping some names they may be familiar with.
Okay.
Farmers close proximity of them.
Right.
You know, honestly, in the farmer thing, they know Joe and Bob and blah, blah, blah.
Absolutely.
So I'll say I'm trapping coyotes over at John Deere's place.
Right.
You know, and I'd really like to try it here, you know, basically.
Because I know as a hunter, as an outdoorsman, one of the most valuable resources we have is land that we have permission to hunt, because not everybody has acres and acres of property available to them. You know, we've talked about Ray Cole. He's got a half an acre, you know, an acre behind his house that's very long and narrow that he has the opportunity to hunt. So establishing those connections is very important, not only for you, but if you ever had anybody underneath you that would like to take up the sport and you would like to pass that down too, it would be important to kind of keep those connections going, because it's not for everybody to just walk up to a stranger and introduce themselves.
Especially
and say,
nowadays.
Exactly. It because is. There's a lot of people, it seems like it's more black and white now, where you got the people that really like hunting and the people that are really all for it, and then the people that see hunting as an excuse to like use guns or, you know, any other negative connotation you could attach to it. So the fact that you're still doing what you're doing and even letting us interview you, this is awesome, man.
You know, most of my permissions I've had since, a lot of them since I was a teenager, I still have them.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them have dropped off because people's passed away or went into a subdivision, you know. So
and that's the natural progression sort of as things go. I know a lot of guys that lose land. Like, I know a guy I just talked to last week. He lost his deer hunting land because the guy that gave him permission to hunt is old enough that his son took over his power of attorney, and his son is a non-hunter. So his son called up this guy and said, hey, I know my dad likes you. You're not allowed on my property anymore. Are there things that you do with the people that you associate with that help you keep the land, or is it just...
Well, I just try to treat the farmers very fair.
Right.
I'm there for them when they need me, go above and beyond.
Right.
And to hold that, you know.
Be respectful
and that, And that trait will be passed on from that farmer to another farmer.
Absolutely.
You know. I mean, there's people on new ground, let's just say if I get a piece, it's not unusual for them to ask me for you know, give me a list of names I can call to see if you are who you say you are.
Right.
You know what
just
I mean?
Like a
recommendation or whatever, you know, just like doing a filling out a job thing.
Like
a, you know?
Like a resume.
Yeah, just yeah.
Okay.
All right, so you get your permission, and you pull up to the farm, and you've never been there before. What's your process?
If I'm seeking to get permission on there, I'll do a lot of Google Earth stuff, see what it looks like from the air,
gotcha.
To see if I even want to try it, mm-hmm. you know? And then
kind of have your spots picked out.
Yeah, a lot of times, I mean, Google Earth is an amazing thing. I could look at it, and even before I get there, kind of pick out where I'd really try to take a closer look at. And coyotes aren't—they're no different than any game, no different than deer and stuff. I look for points, ag, or you know, crop changes, mm-hmm. you know, old fence rows. Just if I was a coyote, what kind? You know. There on every farm there's a line or there's a invisible trail. Crop changes are one of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Tree line rows, points where they swing in close, inside corners where
funnel
they maybe
points
yeah pinch like points.
Yep.
Just like deer hunting.
Sure.
And so when you're starting out, there's no snow usually, right? In October,
right.
You said your season opens down there.
It opens in October. Yes.
So you're going in. You're looking for what, poop?
You look for tracks, you look for scat. The best thing, if you're on a new ground, pick out spots you think might be good, drill a test hole, throw bait or lure down it, come back in a few days,
see
which
happens.
Ones are hit. At season start, only set up the ones that are getting hit.
Just for the donos, you know, for going forward, when we talk about making a set, when you're trapping, you're running a trap line, and to bait a set is just to make a set.
Yeah, sets are there's a few sets that you use for canines, so sets are where you're gonna catch the animal,
like sets of traps.
Yeah, no,
so
sets there's, you have what's called flat sets, dirt hole sets.
Okay.
I mean, there's a menagerie of sets.
Okay.
You know, for a starting coyote person, you learn a dirt hole, you'll catch 99% of those coyotes.
Okay.
Can you walk us through your dirt hole?
A dirt hole, yeah. Dirt hole, dig a hole basically 10 to 12 inches deep at an angle first.
About how big around?
2 to 4 inches, whatever.
Like a rabbit hole?
Yeah, like, yeah, kind of basically.
Just something that you could do with a hand trowel.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then in front of that hole, you dig out ground for your trap. For once it's set, it's... I dig mine extra deep, so once it's set and buried again, it's setting below ground level, which an animal stepping down has more force than an animal stepping.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. The animal,
and that's what's called a step-down dirt hole. That's what normally I run.
The animal will feel the dirt under its foot and put the full weight of its body on that once it feels that it's stepping into dirt, as opposed to if your set's a little bit higher and it feels maybe a little resistance from the pan. Or if it happens to step on the side of the trap and feel a little bit of that steel
and
on the edge of it.
Right. Most animals would rather step in a depression than on a rise.
Right.
So I'll dig out the area for my trap, stake my trap, bury, and then I'll sift dirt over. For the dirt that I take out of those holes gets put into a sifter. And then once the trap is set and stable, you really want to make sure your trap is stable, solid, so it's not rocking. Just like you and I, if we step on something and it starts to rock, we have a tendency to pull our foot
back. Yeah, people
need
to realize these coyotes, they set their foot down how many millions of times every day.
Exactly.
So they're going to know if something's not right.
Yeah.
And you use the sifter on the top of the trap to keep the dirt loose.
Keep the debris.
Yeah, I was going to say, so why?
Rocks and
okay.
debris out
okay.
that could clog the jaws.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Yep.
Sift that over the trap, and then I'll take my hand and put a slight depression over the pan, where
okay.
the pan is. Obviously, you can't see it. You just got to know where it's at, and I'll put
right.
a slight depression in there.
Just to encourage them to step there more or to take away from the fact that they might not step there if they feel like it's mounded up a little bit.
Right. Okay. Basically, yep. And then I'll bait or lure that or both.
Right.
And then
now,
that's it.
I've heard people talk about the deeper the hole, the more time the coyote spends working the hole. Is that true?
No. The deeper the hole... Coyotes have long legs, so they can sit back, and if your hole's not that deep, they could reach into your hole. If you got a shallow hole, they can scoop whatever you got in there without having to dig to get to whatever's in there. I like a deeper hole to get my bait down further, so they just can't reach in there, pop it out, and they're curiosity satisfied.
Okay. On that note, what do you use for a lure and what do you use for a bait? Is it the same thing or is it like a scent lure and then an edible bait?
Well, I don't know how edible bait is because I've never tried it.
Well,
I mean, the way it smells, I wouldn't want to try it.
I've smelled some really awful bait before.
Yeah, yeah. Lure basically has ingredients in there to spark the interest of either curiosity,
okay,
you know, sex appeal style,
right,
sense.
Right.
It's typically ground up glands, right?
It could be lots of things. If you've seen a lure ingredient book, I mean, I can't even pronounce half the names to it, you know.
Oh, wow.
I mean, what I leave that up to the specialist. Right. All my bait and lure I buy commercially.
Okay.
You know, if you had to really go basic, you can't go wrong with really beaver meat or deer meat.
Right.
You know.
Something
what are the coyotes eating, right? You know.
Exactly.
There's not a day we don't go in the woods that we don't see coyote scat without deer hair in it.
Right, yeah.
You know.
If you ever get to see coyote scat in the wild, you'll know it's either got rabbit fur, deer fur,
bones,
you know, they're not, they don't eat like canned dog food or bagged dog food like your canine does at the house. It's a much more wild and a much more hairy.
It could be a lot darker too because they eat a lot of blood.
Yeah.
Soft tissue.
Right. It's a much more wild diet. So
yeah,
you'll notice that in the scat, which is also what helps you identify where they are.
Sure.
You know when you see poop that's got a bunch of hair in it, this isn't deer poop, this isn't rabbit poop, this isn't turkey poop or whatever. You know it's dog poop.
Right.
Specifically the size and the shape and the makeup of a coyote or what they're eating or.
Right.
So your typical foothold set then, it looked like basically there's a rabbit hole and it looks like the dirt got flung out of it, which is where it's gonna
looks
step.
Like a dug up canine hole.
Gotcha.
Like your dog digging up a something in the yard.
Right. Bait,
that's what it looks like.
Bait or lure in the hole. They come at it. Now your footholds, are they offset? How are,
like, I like mine straight back, as close to the hole as I can. There's trappers that like it set back and to the right, set back to the left. You know, me personally, I like it straight back as close to the hole as
just
I can.
One?
Yeah, just one.
Okay.
And normally each location, I'll put two. To increase my chances, okay. I may put one combination of two sets. One combination of lure and bait in one, and one combination of lure and bait or lure or bait, whatever, in another. We may not want pork chops, tonight.
Right.
We may want lasagna.
Right.
So I'm just giving that coyote more offerings.
Okay. Now, how far apart do you? You said you'll set to it at one location.
Depends on the location, but typically I never want them to reach themselves. So okay. As close as not reaching themselves and as far away as, you know, sometimes 20 yards, just maybe okay. There's a good spot here and then 20 yards away there's another nice good spot.
Okay, so do you always try to have at least two sets then? Or is it...
I do.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Just to better
it's not necessary, but I double up many, many, many times.
Well, you know. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
It's doubling your chances of success, and that's the name of the game. Mm-hmm. When you're doing something this labor-intensive, this time-intensive, you want to reap the maximum reward, you know, to justify spending as much time as you do out there.
Sure, sure.
Walking around, chasing these things down.
So how often do you move your sets?
Almost hardly ever.
Thank you.
I mean, I guess I'm a bad one to ask because everything I've got, all my farms I've had for many years, so I don't even have to do anything. I just go on there and know where to set them, you know, but that, a lot of that comes from trial and error.
Right.
So if you ain't getting hit somewhere, or if this set's not connecting for in the first week, you may want to try to find a different location, or you set up every location and then scale back after that. There ain't no use going out there and checking five empty traps and one getting hit. I'd rather have, you know, or just scale back, put those traps somewhere else.
So if you have an area where you get a little more activity, do you focus your attention on that area specifically?
I may plug in another set or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you – what's the purpose of swivels?
Swivels keeps the chain from binding up. And that is highly – that's my number one recommendation for any trap. Doesn't matter if you're trapping muskrats – coon, whatever, more swivels the better. My traps have a minimum of 3. My rat traps have 4. So swiveling keeps that chain from binding up. If that chain binds up, the trap binds up, they very easily twist out of there.
Right. It allows them to take that the torque that they put into twisting their body to work it against the mechanism of the trap,
sure,
and free whatever part of their body is stuck in it, whereas a swivel will just let that trap spin and free spin.
Spins with the animal.
All they're doing is just spinning themselves into being tired, which would make it easier for you when you get up to them if they're still alive.
Yeah, they're always still alive unless a deer hunter comes shoots them or something.
Well, yeah.
Foot traps are always still alive, always.
Okay. And just a 22 is humane.
Yeah, that's what I do. Yeah, I shoot.
Some people use a ball bat. I've seen.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
I don't either.
That is a means of dispatching something.
It's efficient for the. Okay, so.
I don't like to get that up close and personal with them myself, you know.
Yeah, not only is it dangerous, but, I mean, to me, just smashing something in the head with a baseball bat seems a little bit, you know. I'd rather just pop in the back of the head with a .22 and be done with it.
Right.
And,
the reason people would use a ball bat or the what do they call it, the heart stop or...
Yeah, a broomstick would work just as well as a baseball bat. I've seen guys, I've talked to guys that have trapped before or... His coyote retrieval method is a broomstick whack on the end of the snout.
Yep.
That'll knock them out, and then you flip them over on their back, and you said heart stomp. That's exactly what it is, where you stomp.
Hemorrhaging of the heart.
Exactly.
And the reason for doing that is so you don't put any holes in the hide, basically.
Right. Very true. And honestly, I've done that before. I used to do that all the time. Just, I have a lot of places set up. 22 is fast.
Right.
It's very efficient. Humane, you know. There's farmers that may not want you to take a gun onto their property. And I know in the state of Michigan, it's kind of funny if you're taking a .22 onto a farm during deer season. I don't know what the legality of it, but Indiana, we don't have that problem, but there might be farmers that say, hey, I don't want you using a gun on my property.
Right.
So there's methods that you have to do to entertain the farmer.
And there are ways to work around if you're not allowed to use a firearm, or if you're adverse to using a firearm to begin with, you don't have to use a firearm if you don't want to. It's just a little bit faster, a little bit, we'll call it more humane, cleaner in the long run. If you're into it seriously and you're doing it a lot, it speeds up the process. It definitely makes it easier on you. How long would you say, you know, a typical day, how many miles... Do you travel?
If my wife's listening to me, I don't want to say anything. It just really depends on my work schedule.
Okay.
You know, let's say I'm on, I work a lot of hours. So
sometimes
I try to set up my line for the season before the season even starts. So I usually tend to run longer early in the season before I know I may have a work schedule that's going to intervene.
Right.
And then as it gets colder, the roads get worse, I draw in closer to home.
Okay.
So, I mean, it really varies.
Okay.
You know.
So I know guys that talk about going out and walking 2 or 3 miles per line, and these are the guys that might work, you know, 8 to 5 and have all the time in the world to do it. I'm like you. I work a lot myself. If I were to get into trapping, I would have such a very limited window to get out and actually check my traps in. I would want it to be as concise as possible, which also kind of drives home you want to be as efficient as possible when you're doing it. You want to maximize the potential that you can get out of your set. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it. I mean, I'm all for being out in the woods and having a good time and enjoying it, but if you're going to do something as labor intensive as trapping, you really want to be good at what you're doing to make it worth spending the time doing it. And it's that ancient reward system where you put in the time to do it. You want to be rewarded with, you know, animals in your traps, you know, that's success.
Tight chains.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So I'm sure snow is a huge problem then.
Sure. When snow comes in, that's when I switch over to, most of the time I'll switch over to snares. Once Mother Nature starts freezing, thawing, it gets harder to run footholds, even if there is no snow.
Right.
You know, so I typically will move to snares then.
So now, if you know there's going to be a big snowstorm when you got your footholds out, do you go close them before?
It really depends on what the it depends on what they're really calling for.
Like this.
I don't run a lot of sets. Honestly, I don't run a lot of sets. You know, I'm
you know where you need to be.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I may have a farm that has four sets on it, and the next one has four.
Right.
Where a beginner may have 12 or 14 on there, but again, they're learning. They don't know where those sweet spots are.
Right.
You know? So, you know, and if we're really going to get dumped on, sometimes, and most of the time, our weathermen aren't accurate.
Yeah.
So I'll roll the dice on it. I'll roll the dice. A lot of times, I mean, I'll get burnt, but so no, I myself don't snap them. I have fellow trappers that do, you know, I'd rather roll the dice.
Well, because even if you got, say, you know, 2.5 feet of snow on top of your foothold, that's going to melt eventually, right? And your trap's still going to be set and good to go.
I mean, just because it's under 2.5 foot. Now, I do, if I see the weather as we progress into the season, we all know it gets worse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I use wax dirt that doesn't freeze.
I was going to ask you about that. How do you make wax dirt?
There's several different ways.
Do you make it?
I make it. Okay. Yeah. There's several different ways. In the summer, you just get dirt, spread it out on a tarp. I buy my wax from.
Can I back you up for just a second? People will talk about taking. You just said get dirt. A lot of people use ant hills.
Because anthill dirt is actually, the ants can they put something on that dirt.
But they're spit or something.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. I don't see that many anthills, so
you'd have to get a lot of anthills.
Well, so I mean, they
but exactly. I mean, if you had it, I mean, I've seen ant mounds, you know, out that I'd collect it, but there's not enough around here.
So you don't use that to make your wax dirt; that you just use that.
That's a natural dirt that you could use that doesn't, or is, you know, it doesn't freeze as fast as something else.
Okay.
So I make sure I have my stuff and prepare it way ahead of time in the season. The best time to make wax dirt's in the summer when the sun's, you know, it's hot out, sun's right, directly overhead the longer. Dirt. Yep. Dry dirt, sprinkle wax on it, let the sun do all the work. Once that wax melts, just start mixing it together, you know, and collecting it. You can do it over a stove. You could do it over a wood stove. There's guys that take cement mixers and put a flame on them underneath. Heat them up and mix and throw the wax and the dirt in there as it's mixing.
Like a weed burning torch underneath.
Yeah,
it
sure. Exactly what it is. Yep.
Okay. And the purpose for wax dirt is so it doesn't freeze and bind up your trap.
Correct. And under freeze thaw conditions, you know, thaw during the day, freeze at night, that will not freeze. It'll stay working. It'll stay working with snow, rain. It just stays working all the time.
Another thing with when we get the snow, does that also kind of help show you where the animals are traveling to help you?
Sure.
That's would be more beneficial for snaring, right? Because you know what path they're taking. You know sort of where to set your snares because you can see where they're traveling through the snow to get from point A to point B, whatever they're doing. Yep. So
I try to, I'll do that a lot of times. Most of my snaring is done, I'll put out bait in certain areas, in thickets, actually.
To try and bring them in.
Yeah. Okay. I make the coyotes come to me most of the time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Baiting with deer, hog, muskrats, whatever.
Whatever you can do to increase your odds of legally harvesting as many animals as you can legally harvest. That's the name of the game.
I mean, for snaring, you want thick cover.
Right.
So I put my bait in thick cover.
Sure.
You know, once these coyotes establish these trails into there, I simply just where they went, I go.
You intercept them and
And typically, when you get something in a snare, maybe we should go over what a snare is or a cable restraint is what they call it in Michigan. it's pretty simple. Make a loop. They put their head in there.
It's a piece of cable with a lock on it.
Right.
That either cinches down tight. A snare, it cinches down tight. A cable restraint has a stop on it. Mm-hmm. To where the cable can only, in Michigan, I think,
four and a half inch
diameter or circle or whatever.
I think it is.
Four and a quarter.
And
so that lock's only going to go to that point, and it will not tighten any further than that.
What that is, it's a little nut that goes around the
crimped
wire.
Crimped on nut,
And you measure where you want it and take a pair of pliers or channel locks or whatever and tighten it up and you're good.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but most of the ones that you'll buy actually have that crimped on them already.
Yeah. The one they come
normally
with
it's
on
loose
because
each state is different. Okay. Yep.
And that is to ensure that the things that you catch in it are the animal that you're after, like not...
Michigan's thing is, from the reading I've done, is the DNR is really concerned about deer getting their feet caught in them.
Okay.
So at 4 1/4 inches, it's plenty where they can lift their foot right back out.
And okay. if you happen to catch a hunting dog, it's not going to strangle them.
Okay.
Speaking of accidental catches, I'm sure you've had a couple accidental catches in your footholds.
You know, I've caught... Yeah.
Because we can't, in Indiana, I know you can't, harvest a bobcat.
Yeah, nor not, have not I.
The, yeah, no,
yeah, I haven't seen any, so.
They're not common up in our region or anything, but there's some stuff that you can end up catching, a domestic dog.
House cats, farm cats.
Sure. Yeah.
Feral cats, things like that.
You got any crazy accidental catch stories?
No, I've caught some deer in snares.
Yeah.
And they are always fun to try to get out.
Yeah. Throw a blanket over it and try. And
yeah, basically what it is. Yeah,
how you get those cable restraints loose is when they cinch down, they lock them. The only way to loosen them is you gotta relax it.
Yep.
And then go. So the more they struggle, the tighter it gets.
Or cut it. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Cutting it, I think, would be the fastest. I don't want to say easiest.
You
got
a deer kicking and rolling.
Yeah. There's no easy way to do it.
It's not a fun job.
No.
It's not a fun job.
Now, a lot of times you're by yourself when you're out checking these sets. What would you do, say, if you got a deer in a snare like that? Can you walk us through sort of?
Yeah. First of all, do you have to report it?
I don't, and there's nothing in the book that tells me I have to.
Right. For Indiana.
Right. Michigan, I'm not sure. Okay. If I have an incidental deer catch, I mean, I've done enough to where I can wing it myself, but I would recommend getting somebody else with you.
Right.
You know, and getting a tarp or something to throw over them.
Now, what if you had an accidental deer catch, say he got his head caught in that snare? And the thing about snares is, when Adam was talking earlier about them being dead on arrival, basically, that's usually what you end up with a snare. They put their head through that loop, the coyotes, hopefully, and it cinches up and it's lights out. So when you show up, there's no 22, no ball bat. You just load them up. So what happens if that happens to a deer or anything else? I'm sure you got
in Indiana. We cannot keep them, obviously,
right?
Because it's been snared,
right?
I just drag them into the bush and use them.
And they still make a report of them, huh?
Nope.
Not even for an accidental death.
Nope.
Wow.
Not that I'm aware of. I've never seen anything in the books about it.
Which isn't that uncommon.
I don't know about other guys. I don't catch that many, but I have caught them.
Right, because it's on the off chance that you would catch one like that, and it's not that you're targeting that particular species, but I would assume that it happens so infrequently that hopefully it wouldn't make that big of a difference, obviously. Otherwise, they would make you report it.
Deer are curious animals, is why I ask. I mean, they'll put their, if they smell something off-putting, to me anyway, it seems like they'll always go check it out.
Well, a lot of times, too.
Well, with snares, you're not using scents. And I try to stay away from my bait piles because, yeah, I'm snaring anywhere from...
I imagine that you'd put your, like, you'd have a bait pile and have snares all the way around it.
No, not at all. I watch where the coyotes are coming in. I set back. I may have 20 feet or 20 yards of trail.
Right.
So I'll set back, catch one there, and then I'll have to change and go up a little more where it narrows down, catch another one there.
That's the thing with the
snare. Or I'll see where they're circling the bait, you know, at 100 yards and snare them out of there. So
the snare is more of you'll catch them on like a well-traveled path. It's not something that they're going into food for. It's something that they're traveling to and from places for.
I mean, obviously they follow deer trails.
Exactly. Yeah, I was going to say, talk about a deer getting caught in the snare. A deer will follow the same trails. Any animal in the woods.
It's more they will follow the same trails as deer from my experience.
Right.
Because like, they kind of pattern along with them, you know.
Well, any animal in the woods will take the path of least resistance for the most part. So if there's a path already beaten down, a lot of animals will use that same path. So it's not uncommon to get deer in your snare. You know, it doesn't happen all the time, and you hope it doesn't happen last year. Right.
The last season, I didn't have any.
And I talked about this in episode 4. You know, I've only had 2 seasons of trapping under my belt. This year was kind of a shit show. But I've had most of my luck with snares, and it was off the basis of if you see a coyote track, set a snare.
Right.
If you can find a pinch point, set a snare because he's going to come back. And I do, before that, I had no idea. I didn't know they ran like that. I thought when you see them trotting through a field or running through the woods, they were just kind of running randomly hunting, but they run an actual pattern.
I go by the same thing. Where a coyote steps once, it'll step twice.
Right.
It may be 3 weeks from now. It may be tomorrow. But I do the same thing.
Well, it's like us. We're all creatures of habit. For the most part, we all like to do things that make us comfortable. So traveling around for a coyote, someplace he's already been, will make him comfortable. He'll know his surroundings enough to feel comfortable going back there. And that's where you try to capitalize on that sort of malaise that they get traveling back and forth wherever they're going to go. You have to be the guy that steps in as the alpha, you know.
Sure.
To handle.
You want to walk us through how you actually set your snares? Because a lot of people don't. They don't even know. They just know it's a loop.
Okay. I mean, what I try to look for is once I find a coyote track, I try to set a snare in the tightest spot of that trail. And then,
which to set a snare, you need your snare, your cable string and wire.
Right. Right. You need something to anchor it with,
mm-hmm.
a support wire of some sort,
which typically to help support
the snare. The support wire, supports your snare, and it should be able where you can adjust your support wire to determine the height that you want to the height of the snare off the ground.
Gotcha.
So a coyote's 12-inch 10 to 12 right. loop, 10 to 12 off the ground.
Okay.
Or I try to find the tightest spot in the trail, where I know his head is going. It may be smaller than that.
Right.
You know. And it helps also, finding the tightest spot in the trail helps blend in that snare so you have less refusals and stuff.
Because you'd be surprised, you'd think, how can this animal stick his head into a loop? But if you stick it, like you said, a tight spot in the trail where there's a lot of sticks and grass and other things, it looks just like it's part of the landscape.
Yep.
And or they have no idea.
I've seen people use fence lines before where there's like an old stand of a running, like a cattle fence or something, or a barbed wire fence where there's a particular section where you see them moving through, and it might be a hole 12 by 12. It might not be a very big hole at all, mm-hmm. but that gives you the perfect pinch point to set up your snare.
Well, in Michigan, you can't set a fence, so.
Okay, that's.
Indiana, we can. In Michigan, you got to stay away from them.
Okay.
Typically, they're called crawl-unders, where they're crawling underneath the fence.
Gotcha.
Okay.
But in Michigan, you cannot set where he can reach the fence.
Okay.
You can set by the fence just as long as he can't reach it.
I imagine that's probably got to be because there's probably other things.
Because of the entanglement of a coon dog or something.
Yeah.
Right.
He jumps over the fence and hangs himself or something.
Right. Right. You don't want that. But.
And plus, fences tear up the fur. I don't like to set up under crawl unders because it just tears them running around.
And that's right where the guard hairs are.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The back right there. Yeah.
So, okay, let's talk about guard hairs. Is there a time where the guard hairs come out after like the first freeze or after the first snow?
So an animal comes into prime,
mm-hmm.
and then it goes out of starts going out of prime. So like I said, our coyotes come into prime roughly last week of December or last week of November into December. Come January, they start fading out of prime, going into their spring hide. Okay. So, prime fur brings the most money.
Right.
Right.
Are there different categories of fur? You say prime fur brings the most money. What are the differentiate as far as the fur goes? Prime fur is the thickest, the most luxurious, with the best guard hairs.
Right. And their leather, their leather or the skin turns to a whitish color.
Okay.
It goes from blue to white and then starts fading back to a blue in the spring.
Are there increments, like does it step down from prime to a middle level to a lower level, or is it just prime, not prime?
I mean, you get down to the nitty-gritty, mm-hmm. and it's all in numbers off of so where I sell my fur, once it's sold, I get a sheet back that tells me, okay, this coyote was this color, and they represent these by numbers or letters.
Right.
And I can tell that coyote that sold was, I could tell by the numbers and the letter abbreviations how good a quality that coyote was.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Do you get more money for color phase coyotes?
No, less money.
Really?
If sellable at all, because there's not enough of them to make anything with.
Okay.
Wow. Like these red phase coyotes that we have, they'll sell cheap. A, the market doesn't, the demand isn't there for them. And you can't, you just can't get enough of them to make anything with.
What are there different color phases? Is there like a red phase, like you said? There's a maybe
yeah.
A black
we have
phase
a around or... here. We do have a red phase. Some years there's a, I would say there's quite a few. Mm-hmm. And then some years, like last season, I caught maybe two.
Okay.
You know, but there's been seasons like, and especially it might be a family of them because I went on to farms and every coyote I caught off there was
had the same...
was that phase of color.
Right.
But color in general, there's almost not no two coyotes. They may look the same to you when they're running across the road,
right.
But if you lay them side by side, if I laid all 70 of my coyotes next to one another, there's not hardly any that match one another.
Everyone would be unique, just like people.
Sure.
Everybody's got a different hair color, a different hairstyle, a different, you know, makeup.
I mean, for the demand right now is for paler colored coyotes.
Okay.
So, I mean, and Indiana and Michigan have poor coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
Coyotes take on the color of their environment.
Right.
That's why we have a lot of browns and stuff like that.
Okay.
Kansas, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, they're much more pale because of their environment.
Okay.
And they're, well, I mean, and also those are colder states typically.
So they would have a better...
better quality fur and better color.
And okay. They'd be a little bit bigger too, you think, huh?
No, actually they're smaller, believe it or not.
Up in Montana. Okay. Oh,
really? Well, I don't know about Montana, but Kansas coyotes, they average, and I only know this because my buddies go to Kansas and trap.
Right.
Your dogs will, or your coyotes will run 25 to maybe 30. Here, we generally, they'll run 30 to maybe 40, 25 to 40 pounds.
Okay.
We have bigger dogs here because they're eating deer. They evolved. Coyotes are evolving to chase or to kill whatever their mainstay of their food is.
And that's what we talked about in the last episode with the fission fusion. Coyotes are unique. There's only 19 animals in the world that are unique, and we're one of them that can adapt to any environment, whether they're solo on their own, whether they're hunting in a group, or that they have a family with them. They have the ability to survive entirely on their own if they have to, based on whatever their environment provides for them. So like you said, in this area they get a lot more deer. They get a little bit bigger, whereas out there they're eating, I would say, like what, more mice?
Pack rats, pack stuff
rats,
like that.
Yeah, yep. Groundhogs, things like that, where you know they get a more substantial, a better nutrition in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the characteristics of the coyote.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, we used to never have coyotes around here.
Yeah.
They came, they only are here because of what we did as far as clearing fence rows out.
Yep.
And you know, subdivisions and stuff that, I mean, we made a more open prairie style of ground, which the coyote out west
was favorable.
Right. Correct. Okay. It used to be all red fox, but you had a lot of fence rows. You had a lot, you know, and stuff like that.
Is the red fox harder to trap than a coyote? Is there a difference between the fox and the coyote?
Not really. With the coyote, it's kind of been changing since the coyotes came in. When the coyotes first came in, I would say in the early 80s, once the coyotes came in full force, it pushed the red fox out.
Okay.
I didn't see red fox for a long time. Now they're coming back now, but when they come back, they're coming back closer to homes in little woodlots of subdivisions.
I've noticed out where I work at a gravel pit. We used to have a lot of red foxes when I first, this is within the last 10 years, we had a lot of red fox when I first started. The coyotes sort of moved through, and the coyotes would decimate the red fox. Either they drive them out of where they're staying in their dens, or they just kill them, and just to get rid of them, just to eliminate that competition for food, and then the coyotes move on, and after the coyotes leave, eventually we'll get a couple red foxes that move back in, and we'll see, you know, a group of red foxes kind of denning up, and they'll have that for a couple months in the summer. And then once the coyotes come back in, the red foxes disappear entirely. You know, you don't see them anymore. Is that...
Well, the red fox are actually dispersing as we get into fall. They disperse and look for places of their own. Mama's kicking
okay.
them out.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And then what, as a trapper, I so they disperse, they'll disperse. And then later in the season, when the females come into heat, we get a rush of red fox that come in.
That's...
I mean, this year, I've definitely seen an increase over the years of the red fox
okay.
coming in, staying. They're just a little bit closer to homes. Or,
right.
And even the coyotes now are adapting themselves closer to the houses. I know you guys see it and read it right. all the time.
Being more
it used to be they were very timid animals, very neophobic.
Right.
And now... They're becoming less and less. Again, it's an evolved thing.
You know? As we continue to sort of do the urban sprawl thing, they continue to sort of put up with us.
You have to, or you die.
Right.
You have to, or exactly. you die.
So I just got this timeline in my head. You know, he's saying when the coyotes started moving in full force was right. early 80s. And we talked about in episode 4, Nixon in 72 signed the paper to stop the biological surveys, poison campaigns, which is... I mean, so that's, you know, less than 10 years. Bam.
Here come the coyotes roaring back, kind of giving people like you more stuff to do in your free time, trapping. And
sure, sure.
When you first started, were you after more coyotes or?
Strictly red fox.
Okay.
It was funny because, I mean, when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I didn't drive, so I had to walk to everywhere
right.
I went. And I grew up in Granger, so St. Joe Farms is right down the road. So I got a couple farms, and I only trapped a couple farms, but it's strictly for red fox. And I remember the day that I caught my very first coyote was in a snare. And as I was approaching him, he was alive in a snare, actually. Uh-huh. And as I approached him, he broke the wire and went off. And I went home and told my dad, yeah, I had a coyote today. And he's like, oh, you're full of shit.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's exactly what
we
he said.
I
said, man, Dad,
here.
I'm telling
yep.
you. 2 weeks later, I caught that same coyote. He had that snare around his neck.
No kidding.
And so I brought him home. My dad wasn't home from work. And hung him from the apple tree we got in the back. And he got home. I said, Dad, look in the backyard. He's like, I'll be damned,
yeah.
you know. And then ever since that was in probably 19, I'm, I guess, 82, 83, somewhere in there. And then every season is just more and more coyotes, more and more, you know.
Now, before I forget, well, I got this fresh in my mind. My dad, I was just talking to him this morning about, we were talking pheasants again, and we got on the subject of when their population started to go down. And I was trying to relate that to the coyotes. He said the skunk population went out of control for a while.
Right, and that's something I catch very few of.
Really?
Very few of them.
I was going to say,
I've
you don't,
never
they're
seen,
not really that common now.
I mean, maybe they are somewhere else,
I see
but
every
here,
now and then.
I don't, yeah. I
usually
don't.
In the springtime when they first wake up, they kind of
yeah.
get out, you'll
it's
smell
not,
them in the
you,
roads.
You see them in the spring because that's during the time they're looking for mates.
Right. That's they get out you and know? Start wandering around, and that's where you'll see them in the road most of the time.
I just saw one Thursday at work, yeah.
Yeah. We don't have, we don't have a overpopulation of skunks at all.
I was just curious if you knew anything about that, because I just like,
I mean I recall my father telling me about pheasant as I was growing up. You know, I didn't, not saying I didn't see pheasants, because I very occasionally did,
right?
But I think the blizzard of 78 really took a toll on them.
Well, yeah, he said, you know, the same thing Paul Reese said about the fence lines and whatnot.
Yep. And us taking their habitat out,
the right. skunks. He said, you know, for people who don't know, one of the skunks, their favorite meals is eggs. They'll eat
yeah.
ground nesting bird eggs. And he said DDT and pesticides.
Herbicides.
Yeah,
and yeah exactly. I do think that took a toll on. So, I mean, obviously you're not going to find out because them companies don't want that
yeah.
kind of stuff out.
Yeah, there's a
I
big
mean, muskrats,
I'm sure there's...
Muskrats, prime example. We used to have them all over. Now it's tougher and tougher and tougher to find a muskrat, you know. And I mean, although I can't prove it, I do think the stuff that the farmers use in their fields and stuff, drainage gets into
the
these creeks.
And
yeah, I think that had something to do with it.
I'm going to get a little tinfoil hat here. We talk about your dad was surprised when you brought home a coyote. Have you seen any, like, mountain lions? Has there been any,
no.
like, okay?
Panthers, mountain lions, bobcats. I personally, and I'm out there every day.
Right.
Look at how many trail cameras are in the woods.
Yep.
I have not seen, never. I mean, I just take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, that's the only thing I want to touch person. On. I don't want to get deep into it, but
I just like to entertain the person to tell that tells me these stories. I listen to them.
Sure.
Because I hear it from farmers all the time. Absolutely. You know?
Everybody thinks they've seen a cougar, but nobody has a picture of one. Like
right. right.
Well, really, the one that really piques my interest is not so much the cougar, maybe in Michigan for the Upper Peninsula and that, but the bobcat down in the Indiana area, because that's kind of a hot topic right now.
Right. I have never seen one here. Now, I have buddies that showed me trail cameras of them, but where I go, I have not seen
it. I looked at a map on the Indiana DNR of confirmed bobcat recoveries or whatever they call it, like where they were road kills or they just found one dead or had trail cam pictures. And I think for like the closest county, it was like Elkhart County, 1, St. Joe County, 2. And that was it for around here. But, like, the farther south you go...
more there is.
Holy shit.
The trappers I know down there tell me they're releasing them.
Hmm.
So, and that's where they're trying to get the season right now is in the southern counties.
So when they do that, Indiana's proposing a harvest on bobcats.
A season for...
yeah, and it's a relatively short season.
I'm not sure. They'll probably... okay, so, like, Indiana has an otter season now. We're allowed 2 per trapper or... once we hit a quota of 600 for the state,
okay,
and which it's the trapper's responsibility to go on and see where that number's at,
right?
You know, I mean, we've always this season. I'm pretty sure we didn't reach 600. I could look it up. Last season, we reached 600 within 2 or 3 days of season closed.
Oh, wow. Holy
so
shit!
So it's pretty accurate. Their harvest quota was pretty accurate.
Nice. Yeah. Well, because because bobcats, those hides are worth quite a bit, right?
Not for our state, they won't be.
Really?
Again, they want luxury, full furred.
So you want like a northern...
yeah, you want Montana cats. You want, high Canada. Altitude cats.
Yeah.
part of the... you know, a lot of these animals, these mammals are a lot bigger on the northern fringe of their territory. I know we've talked about this before, but it's something called Bergman's Principle. It's the fact that mammals are always larger on the northern, not always, for the most part.
They tend to be.
Tend to be larger on the northern fringe of their territory than on the southern end. And a lot of that has to do with heat dissipation and some real science shit that I can't get in. But it's like you think mule deer have, they're larger on the northern end of their territory, smaller on the southern end, and they have bigger ears on the southern end. So the ears thing, you think of like woolly mammoths and elephants.
Mm-hmm.
Elephants live in Africa where it's hot, and they have these great big giant ears.
For heat dissipation.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mammoths had those little tiny ears, but they were a lot bigger.
And they lived in the Ice Age.
Right. So just throwing that out there. But so like a Montana bobcat would be, or a UP
high
bobcat.
Altitude typically... you know, I don't know.
Colder
but
climates.
What I've read and what I've heard, high altitude cats and colder climate cats
tend to
bring
be.
Big money.
Okay.
Bring big money. But them trappers ain't catching but maybe 10
right.
at most.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Going back to the old principle of supply and demand, if you're only getting 10 or 20 a year and they are the prime ones, they're going to be worth a lot more money than if you were getting 50 a year, say, out of the state of Indiana where they're not as luxurious, as nice as the ones that you might get elsewhere. So
like, say for you, it wouldn't pay.
I'd want one just to catch one, but they may be worth. Indiana, like Ohio's got cats. I don't know if they have a harvest season on them, but you're looking at a $40 or $50 cat compared to something. I would say Montana. Montana, you're looking at maybe over $1,000.
Oh wow!
I've seen them.
That drastic.
Yeah. That's why I said I've seen them go for like $1,200. They were posting on some. Yeah. You're on a lot of those trapping sites.
Yeah.
I am, and on the post like $1,200. You know,
right?
All of this big ass hide.
That's crazy. I mean, and good for them. You know, that keeps people doing it. That stokes the fire to keep people interested in this the sport, because trapping, in my opinion, from what I've seen growing up, is one of the things that if we don't pay special attention to it, there's only a very few people left in
right. Trapping only makes a you a better breed. Woodsman.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
It's a very good management tool, but trappers are a dying breed.
There's so much work for such, generally such little return for it. You have to be really proud to do it. You know, we have such a profound respect for you because of what you do, and you laugh about it, but it's true. We see, like, I've seen pictures of you, you know, with coyotes hanging, you know, skin stretched out, and I know a little bit about how much work that takes, and it's such an incredible amount of time invested in setting the traps and buying the traps and getting the traps ready to set, you know, taking them out, setting them in a way that's going to catch animals, and that's just where the work begins.
Well, there's never work if you enjoy what, you know.
There you go.
That's where it's at, man. And then the fur care, like
I think jobs got to be like that, you know.
Yeah.
Too bad my job isn't like that.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, if we could all get paid to do what we love, I wouldn't bitch about my job.
Yeah, man. I mean, seriously, you guys are hands down the bad sons of bitches on the planet. I don't care what anybody else said. Seriously, man, I think I'm busy. Jesus Christ, you told me your schedule.
Well, maybe I'm a rare breed or something, but keeps my sanity.
Yeah.
That's how you unwind from work. You go out to the woods.
I've learned, you know, I've spent most of my life out in the woods, you know, hunting, you know, fishing or just walking around, mushroom hunting.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time in the woods, but I've learned more in the past 2 years trapping about the woods that it's like, it's just stuff you wouldn't think about normally, you know, like you forces you to pay a little bit more attention to everything.
Right. That I would say that's true. I never looked at it that way, but you're looking more than, I guess you're looking closer at things than a broad sense of hunting deer. You can take the same turn in deer. I mean, we all do. It depends on how serious you are. But once that work is done, as far as you're in your tree stand, or you got a deer pattern or a buck pattern, you're just waiting for the right day and everything.
Right.
But in trapping, so when you come up on a setter as you're walking to the set, you may see something like, okay, now I got to get after that, or that coyote may do something at your set to tell you how to catch him. So you really got to be really focused. You have to keep an open mind, but focused at the same time.
So a lot of hunting, what you described, sitting in a tree stand waiting for a buck, is circumstantial. A lot of it is just being in the right spot at the right time. Trapping is sort of making that right spot at the right time.
You got a two-inch circle. You got to put that critter's paw.
You have to create the circumstance to make that happen. And that's correct. It takes such an incredible... Just the mindset to do it is something a lot of people don't understand.
Well, to be able, like, you know, we were talking mud puddles in episode four.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't walk by a mud puddle without something like, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on? How many coon tracks?
Right. But just the ability to, I mean, I'm not that good at it. Somebody like you can stop at a mud puddle and just basically give a narrative of exactly what happened in the past 24 hours.
And know how to set a trap around it catch whatever's in it.
Catch him right there.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know? Right.
No, I mean, so... I hope more people get out there and start getting into this, because it's you gotta have time and you gotta have passion. I got the passion, not the time.
Right.
That's my problem. It's fun, dude. It's a lot of fun. Like when you're hunting, you're out there, you're waiting for your opportunity. When you're trapping, it's a little different because
you have to make that opportunity. Yeah. You have to try to convince that animal to step onto your 2.5-inch trap.
Not only that, but it's not like, okay, well, it's dark now, I'm going in.
Right.
You set your trap, you go home, and it's hard to fucking sleep because you're like, I know there's going to be one in there in the morning.
Yeah. Right.
Or he came and just barely missed it. No.
Now, do you get excited pre-trapping season, like the week before? What's your schedule? Are you getting your stuff around?
Honestly, I procrastinate a lot.
Yeah.
And my work schedule intervenes.
Like the rest of us,
So, you know, every year I say I'm going to be ready for next year. I'm never ready. So a lot of last-minute stuff, you know. But... like in anything, the more you prepare, the more you condition yourself to do things, the better off you're going to be, you know? So I try to have all that done, you know?
This is going to sound like really basic. Is there any what is some advice you would give somebody that wants to get into doing this? It is, because I know it's not easy. I know it takes time, and it's going to take a lot of trial and error to get this right. You've been doing it for 30 plus years. You've had that experience, you know. What would you say to somebody?
Yeah, well, you.
Starting out, I would say, and if they have a property, I would spend the summer, you know, drilling holes.
Just getting to know it.
And just to see which areas are consistently getting hit. I mean, that's like a catch to me. Right. I remember doing it as a kid, going out, walking, drilling holes, putting the bait and lure, coming back the next day or whatever, you know.
And the bait's
at the
gone.
Time I had, yeah, that critter dug it up. I'm like, okay, come season, I know this is a great place.
Right.
Or locating spots or locating tracks or scat. It's just, that's what I would do if I was a beginner, for
just
sure.
Spend some time in the woods. Get the hell off the couch.
Yeah.
Put your phone down. Put your tablet
down.
Grab
your kid.
Yeah.
Take your kid with you.
Do some things out in the woods, outside. Let the sun hit your face a little bit. You know, enjoy it. You know, we're only here for a limited amount of time, so get the hell outside and do the best you can with it, because that's what we're here for.
Yep. Weren't made to sit on a couch.
No.
Chuck, thank you so much for coming.
Hey, no problem, buddy.
It's a hell of a time.
Thank you very much.
I enjoy talking about it. So,
all right, guys, if anybody's got any questions for us or Chuck, shoot us an email at racksfursandfeathers@gmail.com. Look us up at Twitter at racksfursandfeathers. Follow us on, did I say Twitter that time?
Yes. That was Twitter.
Follow us on Twitter at RFF Podcast, or look us up at Facebook at racksfursandfeathers.
We hope you guys picked up something from this. We hope you're inspired to get out and try something new. Don't be afraid to even just go out in the woods and walk around. You know, if you get the bug, you want to set some baits out, see what you can see, set some trail cams, you know, just get out off the couch, go out and enjoy the woods, enjoy being a part of nature, because that's, you know, it's what we're here for.
Absolutely. All right. We'll talk to you next time on the podcast.
All right, boys and girls, that is it. We did it. You're going to have to wait another 2 weeks for our next episode, which will be episode 7 with Nathan Brewer talking turkeys. Also, in the meantime, we're going to be recording a Loose Ends episode. Loose Ends and Corrections, I should say. Loose Ends being anything that we started to talk about and never got back to, or something that you guys want us to talk more about, elaborate a little bit more on. If there's anything that, any questions you guys have, if there's a correction you guys have, feel free to email us. We'll make sure we address it. So go ahead and get a hold of us. We want to hear from you guys. We got our own list, so that's going to be a fun one. So definitely get a hold of us. Believe it or not, I already did our contact info in the episode, so I don't have to do it again, but I'm going to anyway, just for the email. racksfurandfeathers@gmail.com is the best way to get a hold of us. I check it every day. So if you guys got something that you want us to see, send it there. Other than that, all editing is done by Kyle Palmonter, and all of our artwork and music is done by Shane Yoder from PutThemInASong.com, who also has his own podcast now, The Root Note. It's a really cool gig. You guys definitely need to check that out. But all right, we'll talk to you next time, ladies and gents.